Welcome to the Church of Mavis radio show. It's Friday night, 7:11 p.m. Central, and Jay will be with us shortly. We have J.D. Walker. Her book is Under the Sacred Canopy, Working Magic with the Mystical Trees of the World. And right now we have bad storms here happening in Florida, and so far so good. There's some tornado warnings, but luckily it's real humid out, and it was just really cold. Luckily, I'm in the panhandle, so we get some cold weather. But we can get 20s, 30s, 40s. But it was just in the 40s. And now it's switched to this weird humidity and probably be some more cold. And then eventually, of course, the cold will go away and it'll be that Amazon's jungle for summertime and all that, which I don't care for too much, but got to deal with it for sure. But it's good to have you here, JD.
Thank you. Great
to have you here tonight. And so what got you started on your, what's the catalyst for your spiritual journey to talking about these type subjects, if you could?
Well, I'm one of those people that probably came to it very early, came to this particular spirituality very early. In my teens, I was fortunate to be able to get a lot of material to read, surprisingly, from a local library. And my parents were tolerant. They kept an eye on what I was reading, but they were very willing to let me just discover what I could discover on my own. And I kept it, kept the interest up through my young adult life. I self-dedicated, it's been over 25 years ago now, to being comfortable saying, yes, I'm pagan. That is what I am. I just feel more comfortable with that. It makes more sense to me than the traditions that I've experienced. And I was fortunate to be able to see a lot of different types of religious traditions as I was growing up. None of the Far Eastern ones. We live pretty far into the rural country there in North Carolina, so you didn't see very much of that. But exposure through either visiting area churches or reading a lot about it in the libraries. So I was able to make a decision to say, what I'm feeling is pagan. What I'm feeling is a nature religion, and that's where I want to be. So, I've been pretty hard at it for the last 50, 60 years.
Nice. And I grew up in Georgia under Christianity, and I believe there's some truths to it, but I definitely get pulled towards pagan type things and shamanism. And I like Norse stuff. I love the native spirituality. Just turning down this window unit a notch so it ain't too loud, but native spirituality, anytime I can get that on here, I love that a whole lot for sure. And and of course, you know, Christianity is just, a lot of the people who were that in my life were kind of jerks. So it's like, well, I think there's truths in it, but there's like a lot of weird conflict, you know?
Yeah, the basic tenets are certainly good. And the basic tenets go across all of the different traditions that I've seen, the ones that I would consider legitimate. But sadly, like a lot of us, we saw those basic tenets get kind of twisted or conveniently overlooked when it came to dealing with certain populations or with dealing with certain topics. And again, when you would ask, when I would ask someone who was elder or someone who was really deeply into their Christian faith, well, what about this? You were basically told you shouldn't ask questions. You shouldn't look into that. You should just accept it as fate. This is the way it is, and don't ask any questions. And I've never liked that approach to life in any aspect of life. I want to know what is behind this, and that includes the pagan traditions. I've also had people tell me in pagan traditions, when you say, well, explain this to me, help me understand this. No, you mustn't ask questions like that. You should just have faith. Faith is a wonderful thing, but if that's all you're living on, you aren't living very well, in my opinion.
Definitely. And there was one time I went out in my backyard a long time ago in Georgia, and I saw these little weird silver lights in the trees. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't bugs. I thought there was like Christmas lights, and it wasn't Christmas lights. And I think it may have been some kind of, you know, wee folk or fairy or tree spirits or something like that. Because during that time, I've been reading a lot of stuff by DJ Conway and things like that. Uh-huh. And seems like a lot of times I can read that kind of stuff and attract that stuff to me. And then something weird will happen or something like that. But I know in one of your chapters, you talk about tree spirits.
Yeah, there are a lot of different tree spirits. That it's interesting how you can approach this. We can look at trees as having energy. I don't mean to suggest that trees are wooden people. They're not. But they have their own energy. I think that's why when we walk through a park or walk through our landscape or through the woods that we have access to, sometimes we encounter a tree that has a particular energy to it that makes it stand out as an individual. There's something unique about that particular tree, and it could be any kind of tree. It could be an oak tree, a maple tree, a pine tree. It could be anything. That's one sense of a tree spirit. That is the inherent spirit in the tree that is that tree. But the tree spirits themselves, we talk about things like the apple man, where there is a particular spirit that occupies a tree in an orchard and guards that orchard. It is responsible as the elder in that particular orchard. Those are a different type of energy. The dryads are a different type of things. They are entities that are specifically attached or associated with trees. That is different from the inherent energy or spirit of an individual tree, again, in my particular opinion.
I know there's some Norse story about, I don't know if it was Odin, but turned people from trees or made people from trees or something
made
like that.
Made people from trees. Yeah. He and his brothers, two brothers, stroll along the beach one day and decide to create humanity. And they make men out of an ash tree, make a man out of an ash tree, make a woman out of an elm tree or elm log, and then settle them in the Middle Earth, in the mid-range of Yggdrasil, to populate the world. Our mythology for the Norse tradition can be kind of limited, and it's heavily influenced by the Christian interpreters who wrote a lot of this stuff down. But we don't really know what possessed them to say, hey, well, let's make some humans today. But they did make them from trees.
It's definitely interesting for sure. Yeah. And I know the first chapter is humans and trees, a unique relationship. What can you tell us about our relationship to them? They help with oxygen and all many things, from food to so many different things. But I always love to sit on a tree or lean against it and definitely feel the energy from it.
It is a wonderful thing to do, to develop a relationship with particular trees in your area. I have a beech tree it just seems very welcoming. The way that the roots come out of the base of the tree, it actually appears to be the form of a human. You can easily imagine the form of a human there with the two arms and the two legs going out this way. And sometimes I lay on that to do my meditation, because then you can look up to the sky and through the branches and get into that meditative state that lets you do what the shamans do, and that is to travel to the upper regions through the canopy, or for that matter, into the lower regions through the root system. You just feel like you are absorbed into the tree and beyond this particular space and time. It's a wonderful feeling. And it's something that I would encourage everyone to do. The thing that I find interesting is that, back in the 60s and 70s, they used to call us tree huggers because we were very tied up in the environmentalist movement. Nowadays, you have people, scientists, talking about things like forest bathing. Are you familiar with the term?
I've heard of it, yes.
Well, it's the idea that walking through a forest has an immediate impact on you as a human. Your blood pressure begins to decrease. Your heart rate, goes down. Your anxiety is relieved. When you walk through a forested area, you can just be. You can just relax and let all of those anxieties and stress roll off of you. Well, why would just walking through a bunch of trees do that? It has to do with the energy that the trees combined create. It has to do with being in contact with the earth and the smells that take us back to a primitive time when we lived that existence. We literally lived under trees and were very close to them. Those things trigger in our mind a memory of what it was to live in that forest. And I don't want to romanticize it very much. I don't want to say it was the most wonderful time in human history, but it was certainly a simpler time. And it was certainly a time when we felt more accepting and more included in the world environment than I think we frequently feel today.
And I know in your intro, you say that you wrote about trees to learn about the universe tree. What can you tell us about that? I know there's a lot to it, but what do you mean by the universe tree?
Well, the universe tree is an idea that has developed over time that the universe can be divided into three tiers for all intents and purposes: heaven, then the mundane plane that we live on, and then the underworld. And different cultures, I found it fascinating that different cultures around the world embrace this concept. We were very familiar with Yggdrasil, where again, you have the Aesir, Odin, and the rest of that pantheon. Sorry about that, cat's back.
It's okay.
she was kind enough to come back wet from being out in the rain. You have Yggdrasil, for instance, where Odin lives up in the canopy region and humans live in the middle region. And then you have Niflheim and some of the other frost giants and folks who live in the lower regions. But you can trace that back through Eastern Europe and find things like in Lithuania, the Osros Media, which is, again, a concept of a universe tree. You can go into Siberia. The universe tree there is Taru. It's usually considered to be a larch tree. Sometimes it's an oak. But it's a way of connecting to the entire universe so that you're not just here in this one place. You can be in the heavens and get answers for things that you may have questions about. Again, if your answers are found in an underworld, maybe by contacting an ancestor who has passed away, you can go in that direction just by using this conduit. That's what the universe tree is. Not only is it a structure for the universe, it's a conduit to get you from one place in the universe to the other place. I was fascinated to find out whenever I started doing the research that you can find this concept of the universe tree in Central America, where they have the Ceiba tree or the Yakchi or Yakacan tree. Theirs is extraordinarily detailed. We talk about heaven and earth and underworld. The Ceiba tree connects 13 dimensions in the heavens, just one dimension on earth, and 9 dimensions in the underworld, and you can move through all of those dimensions. In that tradition, you have to be specially trained and you have to be a member of royalty to actually move around on it. They don't seem to have encouraged lay people to do that. And frankly, most of the traditions that have a universe tree as a conduit through the three different partitions, most of them do recommend that you have some training. I've told people that myself. Whenever you are journeying, using a tree as a conduit to some other dimension, we think of it as, oh, well, it will be welcoming. They'll be glad to see me, whatever I encounter there. It'll be fun. It will be light, breezy, wonderful. Not necessarily. That particular dimension is thought to be occupied by rogue thought forms, disembodied spirits of people who haven't moved on and don't know to move on. Certainly some of the spirits you can find there, certainly some of the deities you can find there, but just wandering around for the sake of wandering around there isn't considered a good idea. I mean, it's gotten quite a number of folks in the past in trouble. They get disoriented, they get confused, they get bad advice or bad directions, I guess you would say, by wandering around willy-nilly on the universe tree. But again, my when I first thought about doing the book, I was struck by the fact that few people that I talked to knew what that symbol meant. You know, they buy book bags with a universe tree on it. Everybody has seen the Celtic knot tree. That is a representation of a universe tree. But you ask somebody, what is that about? And they didn't know. And frankly, I didn't know as much as I needed to know. So I got to looking, I got to exploring. I had a gentleman, one of the things I do is I make concrete artwork, stuff that you can hang outside, or you can hang it inside if you want to, three-dimensional pieces that you can set in your garden, that sort of thing. And I go to shows, and I happen to have a nice representation of one of those knotwork trees, the Celtic trees. Had a gentleman come up and he said, what's that? And I'm kind of a little bit surprised that he would even ask that, but this is the world tree, the universe tree. And he said, well, what does that mean? And I go through my spiel, you know, top, middle, bottom, that sort of thing. And he said, what does that mean? And he kept repeating that question. And I realized specifically at that point that I wasn't as equipped as I probably should be to try to help him understand what this symbol was and how it could be important in his life and how he could utilize it if he wanted to or needed to find whatever answers he might be looking for. That was a lot of my motivation for doing this particular book. I have another book that came out about a year and a half ago. Oh, golly, it's getting close to 2 years. It's called A Witch's Guide to Wildcraft. And that one, I'm talking about very concrete things. You can go outside in your yard and you look around without realizing that there are plenty of things that you can do with the plant material that is just right there in your landscape. If you need to do some cleansing work, you can get some sprigs off of a pine tree or off a juniper, and you can use that to do cleansing. If you need to do love work, then you can pull the blossoms from either a wild rose or a blackberry bush. And here comes the other cat.
Juniper's those weird little bitty circle things, isn't it? And then isn't that it? Juniper, yeah.
Juniper has the little blue berries, exactly. Yeah. And those are wonderful to use in healing and cleansing rituals. But that's a very practical, you know. Discounting of the book, because the information I think is very helpful to folks. But it's kind of like a cookbook, an instruction book that says you can go outside your door, you can find these things, you can become involved in your spirituality more deeply because you have connected with the energy of those plants, you have harvested them at the right time, and I explain how to do that, you have dried them in the proper fashion, and then I gave several different projects that you could do, either in ritual work or magical work, to utilize these plants that were so readily available to you. And that's a very, in my mind, a very practical thing to do. The Under the Sacred Canopy talks more about deeper things that we need to know when dealing with the plant world. ways that you can connect with those plants and ways that you can recognize are not weird. You know, when you relate to a particular tree in your landscape or at the park that's closest to you or at your mom and dad's home that was just so precious to you, you're not crazy. You are connecting with a particular type of energy that's been around frequently, much longer than you have, and will be here long after you're gone. So embrace that. Try to make a connection with that and see where it takes you.
Definitely. And I know you have an illustration, and I'm probably not going to say it right, but it's Anchor Wick. Anker Wyke. What's that?
Your pronunciation is as good as mine. That again gets to the point of the importance of trees. That one is in England, said to be several thousand years old, said to have been around at the time of the signing of the Magna Carta. We have a lot of trees that are like that. It's a little hard to say for sure how old a yew tree is. That one happens to be a yew tree because the way that yews grow, the center dies, so you can't really get a tree ring core from it to be able to count up and say, oh, yes, this is definitely 5,000 years old. And that's just one example. I think it's in Turkey. There is a grove of olive trees, several thousand years old, and that they have been able to document. And the people believe that these are the olive trees that the dove from Noah's ark flew to get the olive branch to come back to him and let him know that the floodwaters were receding. Those trees are that old. People have a devotion to them. In Japan, they have trees that are natural monuments. People recognize they've been around for a long time. They have an inherent wisdom to them, so they protect them. I know in several times in my area, particularly with old oak trees, if you want to get a community stirred up, go try to cut down what people recognize as being a really old oak tree on city property. Yeah. Why would they be so attached to that? Because they feel an energy to it. They have a sense that the tree has been a witness to history, to their history, to their ancestors' history. And knowing that it's there gives them a sense of continuity, I think, a sense that there is a connection to what happened in the past. And it makes them feel better about their own existence, to know that things can go on. Things can live beyond the brief moment in time that we are here in this particular incarnation.
So are trees of life different than universe trees? Or they share some similar qualities or one and the same? I mean, what's the difference between trees of life and, let's say, universe trees?
Well, trees of life are origin stories. In the book, I point out that of all the trees that are out there, it's hardest to try to work with a tree of life. We are familiar with, for instance, the Christian tree of life in the Garden of Eden. In the Mediterranean area, Sumerian, I believe it was, is the Mishu tree, where, again, a deity develops humans out of this particular tree. There's another one in Mesopotamia that was the Kishkenu in the city of one of the first of five cities for the entire human race in that belief system in Eridu. There is this wonderful tree, and to take nourishment from it was to restore your health. The top was laden with jewels. The roots were crystal. It was just a beautiful tree. Unfortunately, there is fighting that goes on, and eventually the Kishkenu tree is destroyed. But by that time, humans have been created, and they have settled into the earth, and the structure is already there. So you can the human story can continue. Kishkenu goes away. We can't access the tree of life in the Christian tradition until we pass away. And if we have lived according to that tradition, the idea is that you will be able to eat from the fruit of the tree of life and have immortality yourself. That is a functional thing. It creates the explanation for how the human beings or how the world came into existence. Whereas a universe tree is the structure of the universe. It's the roadmap. It is the structure of the universe. And if you know how to access it, it can be metaphysical. When we talk about, for instance, the Ashvata tree in the Hindu and Buddhist tradition, this is the upside down tree where the root is Brahman, and everyone wants to get back to Brahman. They want to get back to the divine because everything exists in Brahman. And if you can cut through the tops and all of the distractions of this world, you can work your way back to Brahma, to this eternal bliss. But you don't have to have a particular tree. You don't have to have, for instance, in the Siberian tradition, with the Taru tree, it is not a particular tree that you go to sit down under and meditate on the universe. It can be any tree. And that's what makes the universe tree more accessible than trees of knowledge, trees of life, or even in some cases, spirit trees, spirits that are associated with trees. I make a point of saying at some point in my book that just because you want to talk to a tree spirit doesn't mean the tree spirit wants to talk to you. You may go a long time literally visiting different trees that you feel attached to or feel attracted to. You may be able to contact that spirit. You may not. You have to understand that in a pagan philosophy, human beings aren't the end all and be all. We are a part of the universe. And as such, we can try to connect with different parts of the universe. But we aren't here to command a particular spirit to say, talk to me, interact with me, work with me. The spirit may not want to work with you. I sincerely hope you find some. As I said, there's several trees around where I live that I feel a special connection to, and they feel very welcoming whenever I'm around. I've also encountered a few that said, no, I don't want to have anything to do with you. And that's quite all right, too.
And did you mention the Jiboko earlier? I see this picture of the skulls at the bottom. Is that something you mentioned, or is it not yet? That's
yes,
creepy. That looks like something out of Tim Burton. That looks like some Tim Burton Sleepy Hollow tree.
Well, I find it interesting that the Japanese anime folks have really picked up on that one. The Jiboko tree, and there are several of them. When you go down into the Indonesian area, there are several very, very wicked trees. But Jiboko is a tree that was just a normal tree living in an area where there was a huge battle and there was lots of bloodshed. The blood seeps into the ground. The tree absorbs it and develops a taste for it and then becomes a vampire tree, the Jiboko tree, so that long after the battle is gone, if someone happens to wander by, it can grab them and suck all their blood out. There are vampire trees in Indonesia that will entice men by appearing. This tree spirit appears as a beautiful woman with long black hair, white dress, red eyes, red fingertips, and she entices men and then consumes them. You would think that men would have sense enough to know if they saw a white-dressed woman with red nails and red glowing eyes to run in the other direction, but evidently they don't think about that. So, yeah, there are definitely some trees out there that have a nasty personality. If you recall from the Wizard of Oz, we tend to think in a lot of the pagan stories, particularly the Celtic stories, they talk about apple trees as being very significant, very spiritual. Some of them convey immortality. Some of them are a connection to the fairy realm. But in the Wizard of Oz series, he envisions apple trees as grumpy individuals who want nothing to do with people and will actively run you off if you happen to get in the general direction. The movie had Dorothy and her companions wandering through the forest trying to get to Oz, and they randomly pluck an apple off of a tree thinking, oh, you know, this is wonderful. And the tree gets very upset with them and starts pelting them with apples. So not all of our trees are friendly. Some of them are downright ugly.
Definitely some creepy trees out there. For sure.
I'm sure that there are a number of times, I mean, fairy tales are full of stories about woods that you wander into that don't seem to be very nice. I have a friend who, she was very fascinated with crime stories. And she had the opportunity to go back in the woods here in the area around us. Because people said, here is this house where this terrible, terrible murder took place. And people tended to avoid it because, you know, this had a bad energy to it. And she said, you could feel it when you walked into the area. Here is the other cat, by the way, also wet. So we'll pet him until he decides he wants to move on. But she said you could feel it even before you got into the house. The area, it was dark. It was oppressive. It was just not a nice place to be. So we talk about forest bathing, go wander in the forest and get your tensions relieved and your anxiety addressed. But you can definitely wander into some areas where you're not necessarily welcome.
Does something we talk about with utmost seriousness, and I have a book about it with interviews from different people, is Bigfoot type stuff. Does that ever come up on any kind of level, like anything like that with all this tree stuff?
I've never come across that. No, there's not, to my knowledge, a place that tends to be inhabited by creatures like Bigfoot. They seem to be drawn to, of course, the more remote regions, which makes sense given the crazy way people go after them. Were you aware that they actually had people looking for Bigfoot in the Uwari Mountains down south up here?
No, but it wouldn't surprise me. I know it's like a crazy hot subject for sure with a lot of people. I don't ever go out there and look for them or anything, but I like to hear stories from people that do.
The Uwaris are part of the Sauratown Mountain Range. This part of North Carolina is older than even the Appalachians. And these, you know, the mountain range has obviously worn down over the millions of years since they were first thrown up. So I suppose it wouldn't be unnatural to think that creatures of that sort might be in that area. I had never heard it until people just went bat crap crazy over going to the Uwaris to look for them. But they had some renowned Bigfoot hunter who was absolutely certain there was at least one Bigfoot in the Uwari Mountains.
Definitely. They're definitely out there. I've heard enough stories where I definitely believe they exist. And then if you ever look at that Missing 411 stuff by David Pilates, that's been on Coast to Coast and stuff a lot. I've interviewed him a lot in the past, but people going missing in national parks. And he actually, I interviewed him once in written form, and I had a Bigfoot question in there, and he made me get rid of it because he said, I can't go to families who are, you know, missing people, family members, and bring up Bigfoot, but also alluded to there is a little bit of truth to it. And then later he's done these documentaries. He's a cop and he's in California. And before all this, he did Bigfoot books about native Bigfoot stuff. And, but he basically, he used to never mention paranormal type stuff in his studies, but now lately he's had stuff come out in new documentaries mentioning UFO stuff with missing people and Bigfoot. And this guy's just like dead serious, too serious about this stuff. Yeah. But there really are people going missing in national parks, and it's creepy. And not to say all Bigfoot do that. I would like to think just people, they're jerk serial killer ones and nice ones, you know, that don't eat people, hopefully. But it wouldn't surprise me if some of them might be taking people for sure.
That's the unfortunate thing. Just south of where I live, one county away, again, to be in the middle of the state, it's a very rural area. And I got sent down there one time to do a story, a follow-up, because there had been a dead body found. Someone had been taken out into the woods and killed. And I was sent as the reporter on duty to go down to that area to see if I could get there before the police left and get some more information for a story. And there is nothing creepier than driving through the middle of nowhere on a dirt and gravel road, not knowing what or who was going to jump out at you because cell phone reception was just dismal. I hope they've improved it over the years. But it wasn't like anybody was going to come help me if something was going to jump out from the sides of the road.
Terrifying, for sure. I'm looking at the illustration of Sumerian Tree of Life. That sure is interesting.
That's where you get back to the Kishkenu tree. And just a wonderful story. It's are you familiar with the story of Tiamat?
Yes, I am.
And her husband.
Yeah, Marduk and Tiamat and all that weirdness. Yeah.
Yeah, Marduk was the sun. Tiamat and her husband, and I forget his name right off the top of my head. Obviously, they create humanity. It's another origin story. Tiamat is the salt water. Her husband is the fresh water. And when they come together, they create the entities that live there. But they're obviously very noisy, loud entities because the husband says, I'm not putting up with this anymore. I'm going to kill all these loud, noisy-making people. And Tiamat says, no, you can't do that. We don't want that to happen. But then you get Marduk, who learns of the story, and he kills her father, which enrages Tiamat, and she tries to kill him. Obviously, he wins and separates her body to create the universe as we know it, you know, with half of her body being the sky and half of her body being the earth. And the same thing happens in the Mesopotamian story, where you have creator deities who create these humans in order to have entities that will worship them and will do work for them. And the people that they create become loud and noisy. And so the gods decide, well, I'm not putting up with this anymore. We're just going to kill everybody. And then you get Gilgamesh, who gets involved and saves the world and keeps the gods from utterly destroying everything. The stories get repeated across time and in different areas.
That's interesting for sure. Definitely. I know I've seen stuff about the Marduk and Tiamat and weird like Necronomicon stuff, that supposedly fiction, Lovecraft book stuff, weird stuff and things like that. So usually when I hear those words, I start getting, you know, Evil Dead, Ash, you know, that movie. Like, oh my God, man.
The Necronomicon is another one of those. It's interesting to me how we think that fairy tales and myths originate many, many years ago, thousands of years ago. And that's kind of like carved in stone. Here are our myths. Here are our stories. And then someone like Lovecraft comes along and develops new stories and told people very plainly, this is fiction. This is just something I made up.
Yeah.
But people grabbed onto that and begin to invest their energy in that. And now there are a lot of people who, enough people, I think, that believe in that sort of thing, that they kind of brought it to life. This gets into that notion that we were talking about earlier, about when you go wandering around on the universe tree, particularly when you go into some of the regions, you have errant thought forms. I'm trying to remember the there's a name for egregore. You create a thought form, it's called an egregore, and then give it a job to do, a task to do, and it's supposed to go do it. And then when that's done, you dissolve it. But the idea among some practitioners is that if enough people believe in an idea, then they create, maybe unconsciously, they create these thought forms and they pour their energy into them. And that is why you have a lot of these creatures from the Necronomicon that are accessible by other people, whether they want it or not. There was, I can't remember the name of the book, and unfortunately I loaned it out to someone, a gentleman who did some investigation about this, going through how Lovecraft developed the idea and the structure of the Necronomicon. And then he went and he interviewed people who were fully invested in it, and explained to them, this isn't real. You know, this isn't real. This is not based on anything that we have any record of. And they became very upset with him over it. And he started noticing, as you said, when you were aware of the fairies, you seemed to draw them to you. He began to notice that things around his house were breaking for no explained reason. Stuff was falling off of shelves, again, for no good reason. Obstructions were occurring in his work as he was trying to get things done. He kept running into obstacles, and he felt like this was people working with that Necronomicon energy to hinder him or bring bad stuff into his life.
Was it Donald Tyson? Does that sound familiar?
That sounds familiar. I know Mr. Tyson has done quite a number of books.
Yeah. If you think of it, let me know. Email me. And I'm not into it hardcore, but we talk about it on the show. I've had Peter Lavendone, who supposedly was one of those Simon people that wrote that weird paperback book. He was supposedly one of the people that put out that weird, it's like a made-up magic system for Necronomicon, but it's really creepy. Oh, but mm-hmm. Those little bitty paperback ones, those are creepy. Yeah. Like, those creep me out.
I think I have a copy of that on my bookshelf in here, and I've had people come by and they'll be looking at my bookshelf. Oh, can I get that? No, you may not have that one because you haven't got any more sense than to try to use it, and God knows where you'll end up.
Yeah, they're definitely creepy for sure.
we can create our stories. I was very interested as I was looking at, we talked about tree spirits, and of course a lot of people are familiar with the Whomping Willow from the Harry Potter series.
Whomping Willow?
Okay. Yeah. That is the tree where Remus, who is the werewolf, and when he needs to change, he goes through a tunnel under the tree and can change without hurting people as a werewolf. And the Whomping Willow is empowered by Professor Sprout, I believe it is, to protect that area for Remus when he needs to go there. And I was curious to know if Rowling actually based that on a myth or if she made it up out of whole cloth. And I never could find any stories from English history, anthologies or anything, that talked about a bad willow or an angry willow that would whomp you if you were in the wrong area at the wrong time. Willow trees have a very interesting story of their own. Westerners tend to think of them as sorrowful, melancholy, whereas Easterners, the Chinese and Japanese, as I understand it, look at them as humble. They're not weeping because they are sad or melancholy. They are bowing their branches because they are humble about their place in the universe. And they consider them more positive than that. But I haven't been able to find any malicious willow trees.
I was going to say, I have a creepy weeping willow tree story. When I was a kid, these bullies ripped off one of the things and kind of beat me with it.
Oh my gosh.
I don't blame the tree for it, though. I mean, I like them. It's kind of like fool humans doing evil with something that should not have been done. So hopefully the tree spirit got them later and ate them.
Kind of absorbed them into its root system.
Some mean skater kid. Well, hopefully it ate him and a skateboard.
Wasn't that what Shakespeare wrote about that with in Hamlet? Was it Ophelia who goes mad and jumps into a river and gets tangled up in willow branches or something? Yeah. Or maybe her dress gets so waterlogged she gets dragged down and ends up being drowned. But those are the only bad willow stories I know about.
Definitely. Yeah, any Transylvanian trees? I don't think I've seen any mentioned. I've always liked the vampire tree.
But we do have vampire trees, but the Eastern Europeans don't seem to look at trees in that fashion. There is a resurgence of Lithuanian? The Romuva religion, which again has a reverence for trees, particularly in their case, it's the oak tree. And they see it as, again, a connection from the past to the present to the future. They don't usually look at it as something that's going to be bad for them or it's going to suck their blood out. We just use the dead trees as a metaphor for where Dracula likes to hang out. And of course, definitely, he was hanging dead bodies from dead trees to scare people too.
I wonder what kind of wood he used. I don't know if I've ever saw that. I'd have to look it up, but who knows? We've done stories, shows about him and Transylvania. Those are always a hoot for sure. They're creepy, but I love it. So kind of situation. Yeah,
his legend was to be the impaler. I saw a terrible document. Well, it wasn't terrible. It was well done. But based on the story that he would impale bodies on trees, so I assume he was using sturdy trees like oaks or pines or something of that sort. And they were experimenting to see if you could literally impale a person on a tree and still have them be alive, at least for a brief period of time. And they actually figured out there was a way, if you were real careful and real skillful, you could shove a stake up somebody's bum,
yes,
up
there
through their throat, and they would still be alive for a brief period of time. I guess poor babies being there gurgling and moaning.
Vicious.
It's hard to imagine. We've had
Victor Foyo, and he writes Vlad the Impaler, kind of like fiction history, but he's a Transylvania dude with an eye patch, and really because I guess that something's wrong with his eye, but we had him do the Halloween show, and that was a trip for sure.
I can imagine that would be very appropriate for Halloween.
Yeah, it was definitely good for sure. Well, I know I've always found Celtic fascinating, and I guess what can you tell us about some of their belief systems so we can do some Celtic representing?
The Celtic traditions, it's interesting. We run into the problem with the Celtic traditions, similar to the Nordic traditions. We don't have a written record of their stuff. You can find clay tablets that explain the Gilgamesh legends and stories. Obviously, the Abrahamic traditions have books and papyruses and all sorts of things that were written and retained. The Celts didn't do that, or if they did it, they did it on organic material that has long since decayed. So we really don't have a whole lot of information. You can go to the Mabinogion, which is a collection of Celtic myths, and find a lot of stories about, as I said, the sacred apple trees. There's the wonderful story of Finn McCool and how he becomes the national hero that he eventually becomes, because hazel trees in particular areas, when they drop the nuts into the streams and the rivers below them, the fish would eat them. And if you ate the fish, then you acquired the knowledge of those old hazel trees that had been around forever and had seen all that was going on, seen, heard, and retained it. And in the case of Finn McCool, he was an apprentice to a druid. The druid knew the story of the salmon, the fish of knowledge. There was one particularly old salmon that had been around since the beginning of time. And the story was that if you caught this particular salmon and ate it, then you would acquire all of this universal knowledge. The key was, however, that you didn't share the meal. You had to eat the whole fish. And whoever started eating the fish was entitled to finish eating it. Well, Finn McCool doesn't know this story. He's working for this druid. The druid eventually catches the salmon and tells the boy to go and cook the salmon, but he is not allowed to taste any of it. And being the good servant that he was, Finn starts cooking the salmon while the druid goes up off to rest or whatever he goes off to do. But as the salmon is cooking, a pocket of fat explodes, gets on his thumb, and not thinking, he puts his thumb in his mouth and immediately begins to realize what's going on. Well, the druid comes back and sees what has happened and just doesn't argue about it. He says, okay, go ahead and finish eating the fish. It's yours, and evidently that is your fate. That is your gi. So you get to go ahead and eat this. But it all goes back to the hazelnut trees. Again, I don't know why hazelnut trees are supposed to be so important, but you will also find certain stories that will talk about if you ate hazelnuts in June, you could become a great poet. You could become a great bard, telling stories and singing songs and such. They usually have an affinity for the ash, oak, thorn, hazelnut. And thorn in this case is hawthorn. Those are some of the magical trees in the Celtic philosophy. We get some of our stuff from, the gentleman's name was Iola Morgane. Can't remember his last name. And a lot of people put a lot of stock in those, the tree alphabet and such. Seems to be stuff that he kind of sort of made up. The stories that go way back are legitimate. As I say, hazelnuts being something that is used for wisdom, oaks for strength, hawthorns to connect with the fae folk, with the fairy folk. But a lot of the stuff he seemed to have made up. But again, it's kind of like the Necronomicon. Everybody is drawn to that. A lot of people believe in the Celtic tree alphabet. So for some folks, it's very poignant. It's very authentic. And I guess you can't really knock them for something that they have that deep faith and expectation from.
I know you mentioned a Norse legend. I always have trouble saying Yggdrasil. Yggdrasil. Yes. My Georgia will come out on that one, let me tell you. And the Norse universe tree, I know you say that that means Odin's horse. That's the first time I've ever heard that. Yeah. That's interesting.
If you break the name down, it's supposed to translate into Odin's horse. And it's interesting to me that in medieval times, horse was slang for gallows, for where you were hung. And of course, that ties back into the story about Odin, who hung from Yggdrasil for 9 days in order to acquire the knowledge of the runes. So he was literally hanging as a hangman, as a hanged man from Yggdrasil until he could finally acquire the knowledge of the runes, which of course then get shared with everyone else. But yeah, the word Yggdrasil in the Nordic language translates into Odin's horse, or in this case, Odin's hangman's tree. There's another thought about it as well, keeping in mind that Odin had a shamanistic tradition. And shaman is technically a word we use for Siberian wise men or women, but it's come to be used throughout the world as a person who is knowledgeable about magic and about the metaphysical. So the other thought is that when they say Odin's horse, they mean that this is how he traveled to different dimensions and different parts of the world, was through Yggdrasil. Yggdrasil was his conveyance, his quote-unquote horse, to get to these other dimensions to do whatever magical workings he was going to do, whether he was looking into the future or speaking to the dead or whoever.
Definitely fascinating. And then, of course, his other story about losing his eye, that was like a whale and a giant and everything. Those stories are always just so amazing to listen to. I could listen to them forever, but I know
they really are interesting. And why it gets back to, again, my fascination is, why was it important that he give up that particular part of him to lose an eye in order to acquire that? You want to think that Mimir was just being cruel, or was there some significance at having lost a means of seeing in this world in order to gain a knowledge of other worlds beyond the mundane?
Yeah, it seems like some cruelty somewhere in there for sure.
Well, no, and of course, we have to remember that it was a harsher time. I'm frequently asked, again, when I work in the magical shop, I make a lot of different things. And one of the things I make is ink. And I make it from pokeberries. And you're probably very familiar with poke there in Georgia. I don't know if it goes as far south as Florida or not.
How do you spell it? Pokeberry?
Poke, P-O-K-E, poke plant. Oh, come on. You've got to know what a poke plant is. You're not a good Southerner if you don't know what a poke plant is.
I've heard of it.
You have probably seen it too. You've heard of poke salad, right?
Yes.
Poke is a plant, and it can be invasive. It grows very rapidly from a very sturdy rootstock. Technically, it's a perennial plant, but if you ever get the chance of digging up a poke root, it's as woody as any tree that I've ever had to dig up. But the point is that it grows up. It has it will grow into a large leaf, and then around August, it makes a berry, and it's a cluster of berries, and they're kind of purpley magenta. You know, they're a dark red berry. If you get the stain on your fingers, or in your clothes, it's very hard to get it out. But people use those back in the day to be a substitute for ink, because it would stay pretty well. I have a friend who has some letters from his ancestors who were actually in the Civil War, and they wrote home using pokeberry juice. Well, that doesn't stay very long if you just squeeze the juice out and try to use that, but certainly it would last long enough for somebody to read a letter. But I take that and I render it down, and I make dove's blood, bat's blood, and dragon's blood ink out of it. And it's a matter of using particular essential oils to make the different varieties of those particular inks. But periodically I get people who come in and they go, did people really use blood? Is there really blood in there? No. I wouldn't be surprised if at some time people did use blood from sheep or birds or even people, for that matter, to do writing that they considered either spell work or sacred work, because life, of course, is energy. But for the most part, there's no blood in my bat's blood ink. There certainly is not.
What do you normally do with it? I mean, you write stuff.
You do spell work with it. You can journal with it. I had a gentleman come in and say that he particularly liked my ink when he did his artwork. He was a painter, and he just loved that particular color of the ink. I wish he would have brought something in for me to see what he was doing, but I never got a chance to see that. But the point of using that, if you use dove blood, that is usually used for spells of compassion or love magic, that sort of thing. Bat's blood, as you can imagine, would probably be used for more baneful purposes. And dragon's blood is just a good ink to use for any kind of ritual writing or spell writing or journaling that you are doing that you want to lend an extra energy to. Dragon's blood lends energy to anything you do. I use dragon's blood resin in that ink that has a particularly energetic energy to it, for lack of a better term. But yeah, it's very practical to use and very pleasing to use. I really like making those particular inks.
And dragon's blood is like a plant or with flowers?
Oh my goodness. Pokeberry, of course, is a North American plant. There is a cousin to it in China. Dragon's blood resin comes from a tree in the Middle East. That's where we get frankincense, myrrh, and of course, dragon's blood. It's the resin of the tree. And in the case of dragon's blood, it actually comes out with a red color. Frankincense and myrrh is kind of red. It's more like a rusty brown, but frankincense is more golden. But they are actually harvested from trees. People have been harvesting dragon's blood resin, frankincense resin, for thousands of years. As a matter of fact, the translation of frankincense is true incense. And that's why you find it used in Egyptian traditions, in Jewish traditions, in Christian traditions. It is the true incense that carries your message to the divine. And it doesn't matter which divine you're talking to. In Egyptian temples, they greeted Ra with the morning sun by burning frankincense. In the Jewish temples, you purified the temple by fumigating it with frankincense. So these are resins that come from Middle Eastern trees. It's interesting to me. I don't know that they're trying to grow the dragon's blood tree in California, but there's been some efforts to try and grow frankincense trees, the Boswellia tree, in California. But the problem is it's hard to germinate. You have to have a very particular growing environment. If they can ever get a grove of it going, and it can take 7 to 10 years to get a tree old enough to be able to harvest from it, somebody's going to make a mint, because to have the true resin, it's getting very expensive to purchase, because we've just put so much demand on these trees that have been harvested forever in the Middle East, that there is some concern that, like the wild white sage, it's over-harvested. And you know, it may be, get to a point where it's just not affordable anymore.
I know. I saw the sweet gum tree. It says uses protection and exorcism. Wow.
Styrix. It's in that family of the Styrix. And that's one of those fun things that you find out about trees that, I mean, who would have thought that this tree that makes this prickly ball that is an aggravation to most homeowners off of this tree that is absolutely wonderful. It's a beautiful, sturdy tree. It's very strong. Who would have thought that that would be related to the Storax tree where you get another important resin? I've never tried tapping one around here to see if I could get any of the resin. I've gotten plenty of pine resin before. That's easy to come along with. And you can actually make your own incense with pine resin. You just melt it down and you put some more things into it, whatever you're trying to do. Rosemary, if you're doing healing work, or again, if you're doing love work, you could put rose in it, any of the herbs that are used for love magic, and then let it harden again. And then whenever you need it, you burn it on a charcoal and you have created your very own signature incense.
Nice. I know I've used frankincense and myrrh incense and dragon's blood and all that for sure. And so what do you normally do, like spell wise, let's say to cleanse your house or to change the energy to positive or something like that?
Oh my goodness. What we traditionally advise people to do, what I do, Generally, you start at the north side of the house, open a door or window, and then you go through your house window shins counterclockwise, pushing the negative energy out. Now, a lot of people today love using sage, and there's nothing wrong with using sage. I do recommend that you look for suppliers who are commercially harvesting it, as opposed to some of the other sources where, again, they are over harvesting it in the wild. And there are some native groups that are particularly concerned that at some point, you know, they may lose a very important resource for their spirituality because everybody and his brother wants to use sage these days. My particular tradition would be to use something, a good one would again be something like frankincense or dragon's blood, and you burn that on a charcoal or as a stick incense or cone incense. And you start again in the northern part of your house or your apartment, wherever you happen to live, and you are literally smudging the whole area. You're cleansing the area all around. You go through this room, into the next room, all the way around the house until you get back to the northern part of the house where you have pushed all of that negativity out. You close the door. Now, there are two lines of thought there. After you have done that, we usually recommend that you fill the space back up with something positive. And I might use something like lavender, or I might use myrrh in this particular case because it's a loving incense. Some people feel like traditionally when we say smudge, people think sage. Not necessarily true, but that's the way the community tends to look at it. But people think if they have used sage, that is both a cleansing and a purifying incense, so you don't need to go back and do anything else. I like to think of it as I push the negative energy out, I created a void. What happens when you create a void? Stuff rushes back in. Might be good stuff, might be bad stuff. So why not go ahead and fill your space up with positive energy, with something, again, like one of the positive herbs. You could use juniper. You can use, again, any of the resins. Those are always good. Juniper is a wonderful one to use. Rosemary would be a good all-purpose cleansing positive energy to use. I think it's very interesting at my friend's shop. After the holidays, we seem to have a run on sage. And the owner likes to laugh and say that's because you've had all of your relatives come over and you've got all of the bickering that tends to come with all of those people getting together once or twice a year. So people like to come into her shop and get some sage to cleanse all of that negative energy out of their home. And they may not even be pagan. It doesn't matter. They're going to come in and get some sage because they understand that the sage is going to help them clear out all of that negativity.
Yes. So in all of your path of learning about this stuff and your belief system, have you ever had paranormal events because of it or seen anything like that?
I have certainly seen things of that sort. You mentioned growing up seeing lights and things. That was commonly believed. And I recall very clearly seeing things like that around the house. Like you said, little orbs of light where there should be no orbs. There was no storm going on, but I remember looking out of a bedroom window and very clearly seeing little orbs of light. My mother told the story that when they first moved to the area or to the place where we grew up, her cousins lived nearby, and they would go out in the woods, you know, at night to hunt raccoons and things of that sort. And she saw a light down the path that they normally took. And she assumed it was her cousins coming back up from their hunt. So she was waiting in grandma's garage. She was going to scare them as they came by. And she waited and waited and waited. They never came by. They never came by. So she went back in and they were sitting in the house. And she said, well, weren't you just down in the woods? No, we hadn't been down in the woods. We weren't planning on going down in the woods. So there were little spirits and things like that when we were growing up, and it was just accepted that that's something that happens. You see these things. I remember when I went to, there's a place in Montgomery County called the, I believe it's called the Indian Town Mound. And this is a place where Native Americans lived and congregated for the longest time. It's been preserved as a historical site. And I went there to see a sky watching that we were doing, you know, gazing. I'll get there in a minute. We were stargazing. So, of course, we were out there late in the evening and watching, listening to this wonderful presentation about the different stars that were available or viewable. All the different stories that you could hear from people about what they had seen and when to look for these particular things. And at one point when the event finally broke up, my friend and I were walking back to the car, and from the corner of my eye, I could see a ball of light that was just bouncing along beside us. It wasn't an evil thing. It seemed like a very happy little spirit. And about the time that we got to our vehicle, I turned to look, and it was completely gone. Those are the sorts of things that I've seen on a regular basis. Very rarely have I seen or felt anything really negative. I've been in a few places that were supposed to be haunted. Sometimes I felt energy from those. Sometimes I didn't. But fortunately, I've never encountered any really bad things. I've never had any bad things happen from the magic work that I do. But of course, I do warding and protection stuff as well. I have had things not work out the way that I expected them to. I tell people when they do prosperity spells to do it and let it work. Don't do it over and over and over again, you know, every 7 days, you know, 7 days a week or every 2 or 3 weeks or something like that. Do the work and then let the magic manifest. Because as a young worker, I, of course, was desperate for money at that time. So I did a lot of spell work working on prosperity and realized one day that I was dead tired because I was getting all of these job offers to do. I was doing landscaping at the time. And of course, because you're eager and you're a go-getter, you're not turning very many of them down. Of course, you never know when they're going to come back up again. What in the world? I'm killing myself with all this work that I'm getting. And I realized I was getting all the work because I was doing that kind of manifesting type spell work. So you have to be kind of careful that you don't overdo it, that you don't, that you give the magic time to work, and that you understand that sometimes it will not manifest in the way that you think it will manifest. Just be prepared and have your eyes open for what can come about when you do that kind of work.
And it's like creative visualization, right? In a lot of
exactly.
ways.
And I'll pose this to you to see. I'm guessing that you don't do a lot of spell work. Would I be wrong to say that?
I don't really know.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I have people who are very spiritual. It never occurs to them to do any kind of magical work. And that's okay, too. But I've been toying with the idea that of doing another book project where we talk about that. It's all well and good to have faith. As I said, faith is a wonderful thing. But you need to understand that some of the things that we do in the magical world have a very solid grounding in the mundane world. So as you say, positive visualizations. That is a very magical thing to do. You carry on in life as though you already had that thing that you wanted. And there's a reason why that manifests for you if you will do that. And it's not to say that the herbs that you burn or the ritual that you do has no meaning. It has a very strong meaning. It reinforces the goal that you're working on. But it also helps to understand that what you are doing is grounded in the mundane world. there's a reason why it works. When we burn, for instance, I mentioned the sage, and there have been studies that prove this. When we push, we say we're pushing that negativity out. Whenever we're burning the sage to cleanse our house, you are literally cleansing your house. That sage smoke that comes off will actually help to kill some of the bugs and things. And I don't mean insects. I mean the germs and things that are in your house. When you burn the lavender, for instance, to help you calm down, it triggers a reaction in your brain. You make that connection through the olfactory. Remember, the olfactory is our oldest sense. So that's why when you go into like an old folks home, you can encounter someone with dementia. But if you burn a fragrance that they associate with their childhood, it brings that memory back to them. And they can talk to you. Before, they're just sitting in the tree, or in the chair, and you can't get them to talk to you at all. You burn the right smells or present a perfume that they associate with their grandmother or to a special time in their life, and it reawakens those memories for them. So is that magic, or is that some sort of chemical reaction in the brain? And does it make any difference? So I'm considering making a proposal to the publisher to write a book to try to explain magic, not just in the spiritual sense, but in the mundane sense, if that makes any sense.
Yes. Oh, I became familiar with creative visualization through shamanism a lot. And then there's a book that I always have trouble saying her name, of course, Shaktai Gawain, Creative Visualization. She's passed away now, but she wrote a really good book about that I have a lot of copies of it, that some pages are falling out of it from reading it so much. It's one of those types.
No, book.
I'll tell you her name. You should check it out sometime. It's actually a really good book. Her name is Shaktigawain, and it's Creative Visualization. But that's Shaktigawain. And it's the book's Creative Visualization, but it has a lot of affirmations and stuff like that, and exercises in it and stuff. There's actually a picture on the front of a sage with a staff, like a shaman, but it's a real good one. And shamanism talks about that a lot, for sure. I do that a lot. Definitely. I could do it more. Sometimes I forget to do it, but.
Well, and it does help to keep those, to actively practice. I know whenever I get to the point where I'm busy, and I'm just not as, for lack of a better term, religious in trying to follow my regular rituals and such, you seem to lose the connection. You've got to reestablish that connection. And again, that's not just to a patron deity, if you happen to have one of those, but just to the universe, to connect to that energy in the universe, if you don't like associating with deities from any of the popular traditions.
Definitely. And in today's world, trying to, like, we just feel very drained lately. It's just, there's just so much going on out there with, you know, fear levels and everything, and just trying to find a way to restore and regenerate your energy to, you know, like back in December at COVID and flu situations and all this stuff. And it just feels like feel like a blob after all that, or something, like a scab.
Well, to be quite honest, that, and it sounds hokey when I say it, I don't mean any disrespect to anyone, but when I was thinking about this, this was the idea for this particular book came up around 2015, 16, 17. I was talking to friends about it and other people in the writing community that I respect, about this malaise, this sense in the world that nobody can get along. It's so fractured. Everything seems so negative. Is there nothing that we can latch on to make us feel a commonality with other people? To quote that poor unfortunate fellow, from Rodney King from California. Can't we all just get along? And I came to feel that this concept of the universe tree is so universal, it's non-threatening, it's non-judgmental, that if you can't agree with somebody on anything else, you can agree at least that there is an importance to trees. There is a significance to trees. There's an energy to trees. Whether you want to consider it a connection to the heavens or not, I think you have to acknowledge that there is a special energy to trees. And if nothing else, there's that. There is some commonality where we can say, I'm not fighting with you over all these other things. For right now, let's just be. Let's just accept that this is a thing that we can agree on, that we can accept, and it won't hurt you, it won't hurt me. It'll just give us a few moments to breathe and be in commonality together.
Definitely, and that's why I like to do the shamanism shows. Just in this shows, I kind of relate to that in the same genre, so to speak. Just talking about it and stuff. You hope that it's helping somehow, putting that energy out there and getting people to think about that stuff. And plus, when you do earth shows, it keeps the earthquakes and tornadoes and stuff away from you. So, you're giving props to the earth. So she liked that. Plus, I'm a Capricorn. Christina's Virgo. We're earth signs, so hopefully that protects you too on some level.
I sincerely hope so.
Yeah.
I'm an air sign myself, so I'm one of the
Yeah.
ones out there blowing up storms.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, Capricorn has the pan connection, which is always interesting with all that stuff when it comes to trees and nature and all that weirdness with pan. It's really weird that my
Yeah, and
sign is based on that.
it's very interesting that people ask me what my traditions are based in, and I tell them Greco-Roman because that's what I read the most of growing up. So I have the concept of Zeus and Hera and Apollo and Artemis and all of these major deities. But towards the end of the Roman era, Pan was probably as important as any of those larger deities.
It's definitely interesting. There's a lot of weird stuff about him for sure, and the nature spirits, and there's kind of some Bigfoot kind of stuff with Pan. Fawn, what is it? Satyrs,
Satyrs.
Fawn, yeah, Satyrs. It's definitely
Satyrs,
interesting.
fawns.
And Capricorn's definitely a weird sign, and the Saturn stuff and all that. What is yours, Aquarius?
Mine is Aquarius, yes. It's
Okay.
so interesting to me. Everybody says, because you're familiar with the sign for Aquarius is the jagged signs there. So everybody thinks it's a water, not everybody, a lot of people think it's a water sign. And no, this is the air moving across the water to make the water ripple like that. It's not a water sign.
Yeah, definitely. And my co-host, I don't know what happened to him. He's abducted by
Oh my
aliens, so
goodness. Well,
hopefully
Home Depot is working overtime, I'm sure.
yeah,
Well,
hopefully nothing.
if you've got bad weather down there, I bet truly they probably are. I mean, a lot of people probably need to board up or get generators and things of that sort.
Definitely. It's been great having you on. I'm going to go ahead and close out because I know we went over an hour. And
Well, wonderful. We did, didn't we?
yeah, we sure did. And I appreciate it. It's been a great show, and thanks for the
Oh,
knowledge. And
it's a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for having me on. I do appreciate it.
you're welcome. And keep us in the loop on your future projects, and we'll get you on again. I work with Llewellyn a lot now through Marcus, and man, they get some good ones on here for sure. It's
Oh,
been
yeah, Marcus is
nonstop
a sweetie.
amazing. Yeah, if it's been
Yeah.
nonstop amazing, unique shows that I don't see on the network at all from anyone else. So I got the hookup. I got the
Here's a
hookup.
thought. Are you familiar with Mystic South?
No, I'm not. What is that?
It's a gathering, and Llewellyn is deeply involved with it. They don't start it, but they sponsor it. They meet in Atlanta in July, And it just occurred to me, if you wanted to, if I don't know if you do remote things at all, but if you wanted to talk to them about maybe setting up there and talking to a bunch of people, because they bring a lot of their authors in to make presentations or just be available
Yes.
for pagans who come to this. Because I think Heather told me, Heather Green is one of the folks deeply involved with it. She's with Llewellyn as an acquisition editor. She said that she and her friends were sitting around thinking, you know, they have this wonderful thing that they had just been to up in up in the New York area, and they had some other, they'd been to other programs that had been offered in the Midwest, and they said, you know, why don't we have something like this in the South? So they put this thing together and called it Mystic South, and set it up in Atlanta. So again, if you had the opportunity to do remote viewing, or even if you just went up there for little sidebars to talk to the various authors that they bring in, you might find that interesting.
I added their mailing list. I'll check it out for sure. Llewellyn does it, or is it something someone else?
Llewellyn sponsors it. As
Okay.
I say, Heather Green, who is a an acquisition editor for Llewellyn, is deeply involved with it. I can't bring the other names to mind, but Llewellyn is very heavily involved in supporting it. So if you talk to Marcus about it, he was at the last one that I was at. As a matter of fact, Marcus has a book out or has a book coming out, if I'm
Well, I'll
not
have to ask
mistaken.
him. I'll have to ask him for sure.
Yeah, ask him about what's going on with the stuff he's working on.
I noticed he has a comic book store.
Oh, does he? I
I
had
think
no
that
idea.
he sent me a card. It was, I forget the name of it, but yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
Oh, here it is. I believe this is, yeah, this is Marcus, The Seeker's Eye. Buy, sell,
Cool.
trade comic collections, sales, purchasing, eBay division, and it's called The Seeker's Eye. He sent it to me when he sent me some books. I'll have to check it out some more.
Wonderful. Yeah, I have to look into that.
But I'll ask him about that because I haven't scheduled for July. Maybe they could get some guests, even if it's just me doing it the regular way, then we could do it from
Yeah,
a hotel.
certainly. Do it remotely. I mean, isn't remote interviewing the most wonderful thing in the world? You don't have to buy a plane ticket to fly halfway around the world to get to somebody.
Yeah, we had a guy on, what was that weird, gosh. Pan something something about that show Hellier. It's what is it called? He was just on. I'll have to look him up. But there was some show called Hellier, and it was about had Hellier, and in it I never saw it, but they get into Pan and go into some weird place that has Pan there. But they made some weird I'll have to look for it. But they made some weird online thing during the pandemic and get together and talk about weird stuff. They have a channel and stuff, but it has to do with that weird
Wonderful.
show. I've never seen it, but it was a
Oh, good.
whole the whole thing was from home though, like during the COVID and everything. So it's
Oh my
pretty
goodness.
interesting.
I have to confess that I don't get a lot of stuff on television. I'm not one of those snobs that doesn't like to watch television. It's just that I never seem to be able to catch up with all of the wonderful shows and things that they have out there. There's way too much stuff to see online, streaming. There's just too much.
Yeah, it's too much, but I just got my Baby Yoda fix from Mandalorian,
Oh.
so at least we got that.
Is
Our
Baby
baby.
Yoda still making it through the universe?
Yes, his name's Grogu now, and it's pretty good. They have a lot of good Star Wars shows on Disney that are actually pretty good, so.
That is one that I really would like to see. It's in its third season now,
Yeah,
is it?
third season. It's called The Mandalorian. And there's also a Book of Boba Fett that ties into that Mandalorian that's pretty good about Boba Fett. But there's a,
Yeah,
so many.
that hived off and started a whole new series, as I understand it.
Yeah, and the Book of Boba Fett, there's some Baby Yoda's in it too with the Mandalorian dude. But that Pedro Pascal was just in a good show on HBO called The Last of Us that's really good
I
about these,
have
like,
read a number of
yeah.
things about that. That's plague related, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like these zombies that are fungus related, and you kind of got the idea. It's based on, it's from a video game that's like amazing, has a lot of masterful storytelling, but they made the show after it. But it's based on the concept of some, I don't know if it was a wasp that did something to an ant and made him a zombie, like
Oh,
really in
God.
nature. But he took that concept and the zombie, they're not allowed to say the zombie word on set, but the zombies are like weird mushroom, weird stuff. They're scary. Yeah. They're really scary.
Yeah. In the natural world, there's a predator wasp. I've actually sat and watched one time. And they tend to go after spiders, but I guess they go after any kind of bugs, but they will sting and paralyze the spider and drag it into a hole in the ground, lay eggs on it, and then the larva hatch and eat the live spider. Mm. So they eat the spider live. That is just gross to me. So I certainly don't want to think about people being exposed to that.
Yeah, you don't like horror, so you probably wouldn't. No. Like the rest of us. It's really good, though. It's really good.
There's enough horrible things going on in the world. I don't want to dream up new horrible things.
Yeah, you got that right for sure. Things are crazy, no doubt about it. Especially on the war scale. My God, it's like I can't take any more of that crap right now.
This is just, you just hope that it gets tamped down before it flares up everywhere.
Yeah. Well, it's been great having you on. Do you have any websites or anything that you want to plug?
I'm a terrible techno pagan. I do have a website, Roadside Magic, which I haven't done a whole lot with. If anyone is interested, they can get in touch with me via Facebook, House of Akasha GSO. We have a small group of Celtic Reconstructionists that meet here in this particular area. As a matter of fact, I'll be hosting those folks here tomorrow evening for our Ostara ritual. So they can reach me through Facebook on House of Akasha GSO.
Well, your book's excellent. Thanks so
much. Thank you.
And her book's just J.D. Walker, Under the Sacred Canopy, Working Magic with the Mystical Trees of the World. We appreciate it so much, and thanks so much for coming on. I'll send you the archive
later.
Thank
you, Jeffrey. I do appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Have you a good weekend, and sometime do that Disney Plus and go on the Yoda side, the Baby Yoda. Take a walk with Baby Yoda.
We'll go check out Baby Yoda.
Our cats like Baby Yoda. The cat.
Oh, do they?
Watch.
Well,
Baby
I wonder
Yoda.
If my cats would like them. My idiots went back outside in the rain.
All right. Have a good weekend. Take care.
Thank you, Jeffrey. You too.
All right, everybody. You're listening to United Public Radio 10.7 FM New Orleans. And where the hell's Jay? Week two, no Jay. During his schedule. And he said he'd be off at 7. And there's no Jay. Where is he? I know you're tired from Home Depot, but come on, man. You're leaving me in the void. Only got a few minutes left. I may end a little early, but Mandalorian started back up. Season 3. Episode 3. It's good so far. Those shows are good, but sometimes they kind of like, depends on the episode. I don't know why everybody hated Boba Fett. I liked it because Boba Fett wasn't mean enough. We'll give him some time. Maybe he'll get mean. It's like he used to be mean, but now he's a softy. Seems still kind of mean and rough. Of course, there was some weird episode where it tied in Mandalorian and Baby Yoda to bring Baby Yoda and Mandalorian back together. So if you kind of got to watch it to keep up with it all. I haven't seen Andor yet. I haven't really had time, but they say the guy made a spy movie and he wasn't really like in the Star Wars, but did that show and it's supposed to be good. I know it's got one of the Skarsgårds in it, the father, I forget his name, but you know, the dude that played the It Clown, there's a whole family from like Sweden or something, but everything seems corpse-like lately, dead to the world, no one in the chat room, no co-hosts, the void. We're in the void. The Ides of March. Christina's here. I'm talking about right here in this little chat room. You can come get in the chat room. We're going to let Christina talk for 15 minutes. She doesn't want to. 15 minutes. You can sing. But anyway, Jay, I don't know where you are. I know JoJo will miss you. Supposed to do his politics show. what is that? Mel Gibson, Vince Vaughn, crime drama, Hidden Gem, killing it on Netflix. I like Vince Vaughn and Mel Gibson. Yep, and here's the Yggdrasil tree on a necklace from Christina. Here it is. You can see it right here. But trees are pretty interesting. Get closer to nature and storms won't eat you. You got to be grateful for the weather. Trying to figure out the name of this is the name of this freaking show. Okay, Dragged Across Concrete. I actually think I saw that. It's really long. It's just I don't even remember it. It's been so long. But yeah, I saw that. Let's see who's coming up. It's weird when you're just by yourself on here. Is anybody even listening right now? Anybody out there? Anybody listening? Hard Harry here. It's bigger than a baby's arm. That's right. Let's see. Next week, Carol Day. That's shamanism. Jay's supposed to be there for that. I better write her. I don't even know if I ever did. Robin Trish McGregor. This publicist hooked me up with that person. Robin Trish McGregor. Those are friends of mine. I've had them on in a while. Husband and wife that write books on synchronicities and stuff. April 7th, Don Webb. April 14th, The Beazle. The Beazlebub. April 21st, Ronnie Pontiac. James Alcalon. That's the 28th. And James did some horror books with Al Going Back and Joe R. Lansdale about Universal Monsters and Kolchak, the Night Stalker comic book, and Shakespeare Unleashed. Beazle sent his book to my house, and he forgot to put my name on it, so it went to the other house up front or whatever, and they had to open it. It's like this creepy book. It looks like it's from the Zodiac Killer because it has all this weird stuff in it. And of course, they figured out it was mine, but that was pretty amusing, to say the least. Let's see this Ronnie Pontiac guy that's coming on. Stu looks like he sings in the like 80s hair band or something. Let's see here. Ronnie Pontiac. That name even sounds like it. Yeah, I think he is like a singer. There, is that him? Yeah. Doing something with just like a mop of hair. I don't know. Yeah, there he is. He looks like an 80s singer dude or something. I don't know. I guess that's what he does. American Metaphysical Religion. He looks like the Weasel from Pauly Shore. We'll talk about his music stuff, but is that him too? He's a medium, like a rock star medium. Something, something. That's him. What band is he in? I'll have to ask him. I'm not really sure. But he'll be on at some point. And when is that? That's April 21st. And Beazle. April 7th, Don Webb. That's the wizard book that he just wrote. And we got into May, Barbara DeLong and Ken Godsword. UFO stuff, Beyond Roswell, Wallace Wagner, Teresa Dorsey May, Robert Sullivan is like Freemason stuff and horror movies, the Freemasons. Samuel Chong, this is a dude that claims he got taken to an alien planet. The Thebea prophecy. I probably said that the wrong way, but Corey Hutchinson, that's a North American folklore. That should be a good one, or something like that, or Appalachia folklore or something like that. But that's it up to June. And weird about Jay. Just totally gonna ditch me. I don't even, hopefully nothing weird happened. Cause he said he'd be off at 7. He fell asleep. Yeah, man. I fell asleep. Be right there. Oh, now it's too late. I gotta close this out. All right, everybody. Have a good weekend. We'll catch you later. Good night, everybody. See you next week.